And here we are in the United States of America. We're experiencing something just is not experienced anywhere else in the world. There's a sameness to this. And that numbness, I think, is something we're all feeling. All of us gathered here today, looking at this scene, listening at governors, mayors, chiefs, speaking similar tone and terms, expression of condolences, all the right emotions and perhaps the right words, but it begs the damn question, what the hell is going on in the United States of America? What the hell is wrong with us? And when are we going to come to grips with this?
Governor Gavin Newsom yesterday, after a gunman killed 9 people, then himself, at a light rail yard in San Jose, yet another mass shooting. More than 200 nationwide so far just this year, according to the Gun Violence Archive. It's also one of the worst mass shootings in the Bay Area in nearly 30 years. The gunman's neighbors told local media outlets they were scared of him, that he had a temper. And court records indicate a history of alleged domestic abuse and violent mood swings. We're going to get to the details of what happened in San Jose and the latest from Maggie Angst. She covers San Jose for the Mercury News. Hi.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on today. I appreciate it.
Great to have you. All right. So now, a day later, what do we know so far about the shooter? And just to note, we're not naming his name.
Yeah. So little by little, we're getting, you know, more information. He was a 57-year-old man who had worked for the Valley Transit Authority here, which is our, you know, public transportation transit line, for about 20 years. And on the day of the shooting, you know, he was going to work as would most days, but obviously this one was different. You know, we've seen surveillance video from a neighbor's home who showed him getting into his vehicle with a large duffel bag. And we've just confirmed from the sheriff's deputies here that it is suspected that he had set his home on fire before going to work.
Right. There were two fires, right, that firefighters were battling at the same time as emergency personnel were responding to the shooting.
Yes, that's correct. And we've inquired about the second one, but that is supposedly not tied to the shooting and the fire at his house.
Do we know how many rounds he fired and what kinds of weapons he used?
Yeah, so it's still unclear how many rounds he fired, but we have confirmed that he had 3 semi-automatic handguns and I believe 11 magazines. And those magazines, we were told from the sheriff's deputy spokesperson, that each had 12 rounds in them, which make them illegal magazines here in California, where magazines are banned if they have any more than 10 rounds.
And so there was also bomb squad dogs alerted that there may have been explosive materials at this place of work.
Yeah, that's correct. So there was sniffing dogs both at the VTA where the shooting occurred and at his house. They swept the yard and detected possible materials in Cassidy's locker, suspicion of wires and that there could be a detonator materials. Ultimately, they apparently did not find any explosive. We confirmed this morning upon closer look of his locker. And at this point, it remains unclear what exactly they found in his house related to weapons or explosives or ammunition.
And he also had a history of domestic violence, we're learning, and sexual assault allegations. What do we know about that?
Yeah, so looking at, there's 2009 court records in which it was a dispute between his ex-girlfriend and himself. He actually filed it against his ex-girlfriend, but in the records, his ex-girlfriend has accused him of sexual assault, rape, and general temper outbreaks and abusive behavior.
And what can you tell us about the victims? Who were they? They worked there with him. Presumably, they knew each other. He knew them.
Yeah.
They knew him.
Yeah. Yeah, so there were, up until, you know, yesterday they were reporting that there was 8 victims overnight. Another 9th victim was confirmed. He was in critical condition at a hospital, but then later died. This morning, the Valley Transit Authority had held a press conference and confirmed that they were all employees at the VTA, working in the maintenance yard. Some, you know, had been working there decades, some just several years. It's unclear, you know, how well all of them knew each other, but we know at least 2. You know, one of the victims was the manager of another one of them. So it's presumed that they were all pretty close. You know, they were all working same shift or within, you know, the shift change of one another. But yeah, we're still working to get to know the stories of all the victims there.
One of them was a good friend of a San Jose City Council member, I understand.
Yeah. So Raul Perales is our council member who represents the downtown district and the district in which this took place. And his close childhood friend, he went to middle school and high school with him. And they actually stood up in each other's weddings. And all day yesterday, you know, we were chatting and he wasn't sure what was the outcome. His wife and the victim's wife and Raul were unable to reach him. And then about 12 hours after the shooting, they got confirmation that he was, in fact, one of the victims.
So sad. Well, Maggie, thank you very much for bringing us up to date on this.
Yeah, thank you for having me on.
My pleasure. That's Maggie Angst. She covers San Jose for the Mercury News. I want to bring in Julia Weber now. She's the implementation director for the Giffords Law Center, and that's based. She's based in San Francisco and an expert on domestic violence policy and gun laws to get a bigger picture of what happened. Welcome to the program, Julia.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Well, I want you to respond to a couple things that we just heard from Maggie. First of all, as she said, it appears that he had these magazines with 12 rounds each, which are illegal in California. So I guess that indicates that it's not hard to get guns and ammunition banned in California from out of state or somewhere else.
Right. Well, let me first just say that, of course, my thoughts are with those most directly impacted by this horrific tragedy. And, you know, of course, we're all affected in various ways when these all too frequent events happen. With respect to this latest news that he may have had what could be referred to as a large capacity magazine situation, it is true that amongst the various very good California laws we have in place, there is a law that has banned large capacity magazines. And of course, you know, I'll need more information. We'll all need more information about how he obtained the ammunition as well as the firearms and exactly which laws come into play. I will note that currently there's a temporary block on enforcement of that large capacity magazine possession ban due to an NRA lawsuit. So, you know, it'll take some analysis to look into what happened and how it happened with respect to the firearms and ammunition that he had access to.
So it's possible now, because of this temporary block, to get this ammunition legally in California?
It may be. I mean, this is, you know, awfully complex and nuanced. And so we'd have to, you know, get into the details a little bit more. But certainly policies are key, good policies that could restrict access to these kinds of weapons and ammunition, and then, of course, follow through, implementation, enforcement, and so forth.
Right. And that's sometimes where things fall short. What is the link between domestic violence, as we just heard that he was accused of by his ex-wife and his former girlfriend? What is the link between domestic violence and these kinds of mass shootings and these shooters?
Well, you know, when I first heard about the shooting yesterday morning, I immediately wondered if the person responsible had any history of domestic violence, because research shows that nearly a third of mass shooters have a history of domestic violence. And that's just those with histories we're aware of. And an even greater number, in fact, the majority of mass shootings that occur where members of the public are killed or injured, an intimate partner is also killed. We don't see that particular situation here, but we do, it appears, you know, we're dealing with a person who has a history of domestic violence. And so we know that there's a connection. Of course, every year, more than 600 women are shot to death by intimate partners, one roughly every 14 hours. There are over 1 million women alive today who have been shot or shot at by a male intimate partner. There's about 4.5 million women who report that a partner has threatened them with a gun. So the link between firearms and domestic violence is unfortunately very strong, very deadly. Those who are experiencing domestic violence are at high risk of being threatened or harmed or killed by someone who has a firearm who is their intimate partner or former intimate partner. But in addition to that, what we see here is that there were allegations or descriptions of this individual having been very, very violent towards his partner. So we have to take those threats of violence very seriously and recognize that that person may be at risk not only to that individual, but to the public generally.
Right. So what does California law say about that? If you haven't been convicted of a crime, but yet there have been allegations made against you of domestic violence or violence in general, can you be ineligible to buy a gun in California?
Absolutely. So we have, you know, two ways of approaching domestic violence as a legal issue in California, through the criminal justice system or the criminal legal system or through the civil legal system. The civil system, we're looking at what people may know as restraining orders or orders of protection. And that would include the ability to get a domestic violence restraining order at the emergency stage, which law enforcement can obtain for a short period of time, 5 to 7 days, at what's called the ex parte stage, where an individual who's afraid of someone who has perpetrated domestic violence against them can get a temporary order, or an order that is put in place after there's a hearing where the person who has been accused of the violence has an opportunity to present their side of the story. At each of those stages in California, a person is prohibited from owning, possessing, or purchasing a firearm. So we have very strong laws in California that would prevent someone with a civil restraining order in place as a result of domestic violence from having access to a firearm.
And then, and how long would that last typically?
And that it lasts as long as the order is in place. And so that order could be in place, let's say, for 5 years. And in some instances, you can ask for and will be granted what's called a permanent order after hearing, in which case the firearm prohibition would be in place permanently. But in the criminal legal system, of course, if they're convicted of misdemeanor domestic violence or felony domestic violence, you're looking at a lifetime ban on possession, ownership, or ability to purchase a firearm. So we do have strong laws, and they need, of course, as we just discussed, to be implemented and enforced.
Right. And so that's where sometimes the it falls down. I mean, earlier this week, I spoke with Rob Bonta, California's new attorney general. He mentioned this armed and prohibited person system where people who have been convicted of a crime and are prohibited from having guns, the state is supposed to go literally to their homes and take away their guns, but they have a huge backlog. 23,000 people have guns in California, despite being barred from owning them. So how do you solve that? Do you need more money attached to this program? And we just have a few seconds left.
Okay, yeah, absolutely. APPS, the Armed Prohibited Person System, is an excellent resource for documenting and then following through on these prohibitions in both civil and criminal cases. Yes, we need resources directed at the state level to support APPS, and we need better implementation at the local level. At the time someone becomes prohibited, we need to take action at the local level to ensure that those firearms, if they own them currently, are separated from that individual. We need to ensure background checks are fully implemented. We need to make sure key professionals know about the availability, not only of the domestic violence restraining order, but also the gun violence restraining order, or so-called red flag law, workplace violence restraining orders, other remedies. So thank you very
much. It's all about enforcement. Thank you so much, Julia Weber from the Giffords Law Center. Coming up, what it was like growing up in the Children of God cult. Writer Lauren Huff is here to talk about her new memoir next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Lauren Huff has come out twice as a lesbian and as a member of a cult. It took longer for her to come out as a member of the Children of God. As she says, there is safety in the closet. That's why people stay. She writes about growing up in the Children of God and her struggle to put her life back together after she left the cult in a new collection of essays called Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. And Lauren Huff joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, this cult, Children of God, it began right here in Southern California, founded by a man named David Berg as sort of a place for hippies, right, to find themselves, to reject the establishment and to live this kind of, I don't know, live in the promised land, I suppose. Was that what attracted your parents to it?
Probably. I think everybody, the hippie movement itself was sort of just a rejection of the mainstream culture, and being part of that and joining communes seemed all the rage at the time. Picked the wrong one, but
yeah,
I'm here because of it. So
you grew up in this insular environment, in this cult, and thinking that this was normal? Or did you realize when you were little that this something was wrong?
And I was pretty sure it wasn't normal. The problem was that when we had left for a while, so between the ages of like 7 to 9, I lived a pretty typical existence of those times of, you know, going to school and playing on the soccer team and a stepdad and food stamps and everything else, just as a pretty typical latchkey kid. And then we rejoined the cult, and we were living in communes of large numbers of people. It depended on the commune, how many people there were in it, but some of them were huge, with a couple hundred people in them. And yeah, I didn't really think it was normal, which was kind of the problem, that I tried really hard to believe and just couldn't.
But it was also a cult that became a sex cult and encouraged sexual relations between adults and children.
Yeah, I mean, the funny thing about that is it's something everyone wants to know about and everyone is curious about, and I understand that in a way, but the other way, everything that is so pervasive in your life, something like that, it was just background noise to us. And that was our daily life. Like, my bigger problem with it was I was constantly having to take care of kids and change diapers. We didn't really know another way. It was the life we had. So you really can get used to anything.
Yeah. And you left, you were 15 years old, your mother and you just left.
It was my mom and stepdad and my little brother. My sisters were considered adults, so they were on their own. So yeah, it was the four of us who left.
You just left just like that?
Yeah, thankfully it's not like some other cults where they will prosecute you or chase you down or terrorize you. We just walked out the door. Went back to Amarillo, Texas, and moved in with my grandma. And the walking out the door part isn't hard. It's the convincing yourself to leave. and the convincing yourself to stay gone once you're out, you have this doubt for a long time that, or I did, that, ah, crap, maybe they were right, and what if they were right, and are we all going to, you know, burn in hell because we left? But, I mean, I was also just really happy to be out.
Yeah. Well, so you're saying that you felt guilty?
I mean, there were all the prophecies that they would tell you, and warnings of, you know, what would happen to you if you left. And it was a combination of guilt and just relief that I was gone, and I, you know, didn't really know what to do with any of that. I mean, being able to listen to the devil's music helped a lot. Turns out television and music are really fun for teenagers.
So it must have been difficult to join quote-unquote normal society after that at the age of 15. Like, how do you go to, you know, you say you were homeschooled for a little bit, but then you eventually go to high school. How did you fit in?
I just didn't. I didn't fit in is how I fit in. My teacher signed my yearbook.
Oh, gosh, I was so
completely
sad.
Invisible. I know. my English teacher, my sociology teacher. I really just tried to think of leaving. I'd already, you know, couldn't figure out how to go to college, couldn't figure out what I was supposed to do next. So the day after I graduated high school, we did the ceremony Friday night, and I was at a recruiter's office to join the Air Force on Saturday morning.
Right. And so begins a long, a long period where you are really scraping by to survive. And it's really harrowing to read some of the things that happened to you and what you have to do just to survive. You experience hunger and homelessness, and you move to Washington, D.C. And it seems sort of like you were cast out into the wilderness, in a sense, from the safety of this very confining existence that you'd experienced, I guess, most of your life. I mean, messed up, of course, but I guess some safety in that, right? And some stability.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you word it. Yeah. The cast out into wilderness part is an interesting choice of words because, yeah, the whole time I didn't believe in family prophecy anymore, and I didn't believe that they were right about anything, but man, I really hated that I was proving them right. That if you leave the family, these are the things that will happen to you. You will be homeless. You won't be able to get good jobs. This is what the system, which is what we call the outside world, does to you. That you just slave away at jobs and never get ahead. And it was a long period of just trying to survive. And most of our country lives that way.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to plan a future or plan a way out when you're trying to solve the current crisis, and there's always a current crisis, and it's, you know, I'm living in my car and I need a place to stay, and you get the place to stay, and it's a struggle to make rent every month, and any emergency can send you back down.
Yeah, or any sickness that normally you could take a few days off and rest and recuperate. When you're living on the edge, you can't do that.
Yeah, it's one of the things I hope the pandemic has made a little more obvious to the rest of society is how few workers in menial jobs have sick days to take off. You work sick.
Mm-hmm.
We just passed it around to everybody. I fell over one time working at Starbucks because I had double pneumonia, but I couldn't afford a day off.
There's a really vivid anecdote in your book where you talk about your friend who gets really sick, and he's delirious. He's so sick, and you have zero money to go get him some medicine, but you go out to find some food, and you go out to find something, and then you happen upon this crime scene. Can you talk about what happened next?
That was the strangest night. Yeah, I was going to go shoplift something was my plan. Soup packets or anything that could fit in my pocket inconspicuously. So I was walking down and, you know, staring at the ground like you do, and there was a roll of money on the ground and a few rocks of crack at the center of the roll. I didn't notice that until I got to the grocery store, because I just kneeled down and shoved the roll in my pocket, and there were cop cars up ahead on the next block, and three or four of them. They were clearly searching a guy, but I'm pretty sure I had what they were looking for. So yeah, I just walked nonchalantly up the street, nodded to them, thanks guys, and I have no idea. Some of those things, I have no idea how we survived except dumb luck like that. I mean, that's kind of the problem with it, is it's dumb luck, or now it's if you're popular enough to have a GoFundMe account.
Right. And then you end up working for years or on and off at a club, a gay club called the Badlands. And I guess that's where you found a sort of family that you were looking for?
I really did. I was talking to my manager. He called me again last night. He keeps calling me because he's just so excited to be in the book and that I wrote about him. But he's so cute. But yeah, I was telling him, I found that club at the time I needed it most. And maybe at the time I was ready to kind of accept sort of a big brother figure from him, and this strange sort of family that happens, I think, especially in a queer community. You know, it's not your biological family, but a lot of people in the queer community don't have a biological family because they've been rejected by them. So mm-hmm. We had the older gays who would invite us over for Thanksgiving or for Christmas, and who would, you know, take care of us and look out for us. And we had, you know, the head bartender, Amy, who'd hand out bread once a week. It was the first time, I think, that I'd been around people who accepted me as just the raw, tired, exhausted, crying a lot person that I was. I could be a complete jerk, and it didn't matter. It's sort of that sibling relationship where you may hate your coworkers, but, you know, they're still your coworkers. You're still on their side.
Did you tell them about growing up in the cult?
No, nobody. I have mixed feelings about that, because I listened to all of their stories, and I just never told my own. That wasn't something I thought anyone could understand. It wasn't something, it was too long a story, and I didn't want people to look at me weird. And these were probably the people, and it turns out they are. I'm still friends with a lot of them, the people who it doesn't faze them at all. And more than anything, they can relate. A lot of them were raised in really evangelical homes, and it's really not that different. So, yeah, it's a shame I had that I didn't think they could understand.
Was it because you didn't think they could understand, or you were just so ashamed?
I was, morbidly ashamed of it. That's the secret studio. They just fester and rot, and the very act of keeping something a secret will turn it into shame. Yeah, I was just completely guilt-ridden by it, and it's, you know, it's ironic among gay people who, a lot of them, I mean, me too, I so ashamed and so in the closet about being gay, and I should have recognized that and just never did. That is the same thing.
So when did you decide, okay, I'm going to talk about this, or I am going to start to come out of this cult closet?
To actually just start telling my friends and not being so secretive about it, and not acting like it was this secret they had to keep for me too. That took years. It wasn't until I started meeting other, I call them cult babies. Social media did it. I was able to find a lot of them. And we're in, you know, groups on Facebook. But meeting them and meeting those who were out, and and not hiding it and not caring. And finally, you know, it is like coming out of the closet. You tell a couple friends trepidatiously, hoping they don't react, and nobody cared. So you start telling more friends.
Yeah. What were you afraid that they would think, that you were some, like, a strange cult child, that it was your... I mean, what were you afraid of?
I have no idea. I have actually no idea what I was so afraid of. I was afraid of the jokes. I was afraid of the sex cult questions. I was afraid of any of it. And it turns out none of it's all that hard to explain. Yeah, everybody's going to ask about the sex question. And I have nothing to tell them. Because it's not really something you can explain all that much. Yeah, I don't know what I was so afraid of. I thought they would just look at me like I was an alien. And I... Yeah, it turns out nobody cares.
Well, thank you for coming on the show today.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
That's Lauren Huff. Her new book is called Leaving Isn't the Hardest Thing. Coming up, a couple of California universities are now offering academic credit for playing video games.
These programs don't start with the professors and the faculty and the administration. These programs start because of the student involvement to begin with. They start off as clubs.
How esports are now serious business at universities. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, folks, dreams really do come true. Some California universities are offering college credit for playing video games, and a lot more are adopting esports programs. That's where students can compete in live video game tournaments, sometimes with corporate sponsorship. So for some big bucks. Educators say these programs give students real transferable skills that will help them get a job in the media industry, for doing something they were probably doing anyway, gaming. Marisa Martinez covers this for Cal Matters. Hi.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Well, let's get a definition off the bat. What are esports exactly?
Right, so that is something that in my research I really had to make sure to define. There's gaming and then there's esports. Right. Gaming is the more casual version of just enjoying video games. Gaming you do with your friends, you do by yourself. Esports is more of a competitive take on it, where the campuses that I talk to, they have their teams where they have the students come in and they start competing against other campuses, other schools, even statewide, nationwide, and sometimes even worldwide.
Wow. And so maybe a student might look at a school that has a strong esports program and say, okay, I'm going to apply there because I like doing this.
Right. A couple of people have told me, like, oh, man, I wish they had gaming when I was there, because they would have been right on it. A lot of alumni might say that they missed out on it. But for students who are looking for it now, they have these options, which is really cool.
OK, so now UC Irvine and Cal State Dominguez Hills are offering credit for gaming. Can you describe what that means?
So there are these certificates that some schools offer. Dominguez Hills has the intro to esports. There is another version of it, like SF State, where Dr. Dina Ibrahim, she offers a broadcast class within their media and journalism school. So each school kind of offers it differently. A version of it is the certificate option. Another version of it is offering esports curriculum through a different type of school, like for SF State, the journalism, broadcast, and media school for them. There's not one way to do the curriculum. It's kind of varied throughout the state, but the faculty are trying to figure out more of a streamlined way so that they can all kind of be on the same page.
Right. And the idea being, well, we need to modernize because this is a huge industry, right? And students can make money in this realm. I guess not just competing professionally in esports, but in somehow in this realm playing video games, or at least having a lot of knowledge about them when they graduate.
Yeah. There's a lot of ways that like students can get into the industry, and it's not like they're going into the industry with these jobs just to do competitive esports. There's a lot of other avenues in which they can insert themselves. There's media broadcasting, which is why Ibrahim has her class based off of esports and broadcasting. There's content coordinating, which Fernando Gomez, he started off at his school doing esports, turned into an internship at a small company, and then it really catapulted him into his career now with the Trailblazers as a content coordinator for them. And he does their social media and everything, but he also coordinates their NBA 2K esports tournaments.
Huh. So these professional teams, like the Portland Trailblazers, they have an esports side game happening, and that's bringing in money, and they hire people to run and work.
Yeah, some of the professional teams have like kind of a section of their team that focuses on esports, because that is still it's a budding industry.
Do you think that maybe sometime in the future, maybe not in the far future, in the near future, that students might actually graduate with a degree in, let's say, Call of Duty?
It wouldn't be specifically Call of Duty, and I don't know how likely it is that schools will actually take on a major of it. I was talking to the assistant director of UCI's esports program, Kathy Chang, and they have a certificate for that they offer for their students, but they specifically don't have a major. They don't feel like there's enough there to support a major. So I don't know about the near future for majors. There might be more certificates coming up within California for each of, you know, for schools in California, for universities in California. I'm not quite sure about major based.
Right now, but you never know. I guess I'm also wondering, like, can't these students actually teach the instructors a thing or two? Like, they're probably coming into it with a vast knowledge of video gaming and esports that the teachers may not have.
I will say one of the things that I noticed when I was doing the research for this is that these programs don't start with the professors and the faculty and the administration. These programs start because of the student involvement to begin with. They start off as clubs that are based off of students. And then because there's such an interest in esports and gaming, faculty start supporting these students in these clubs, and then they turn into programs where esports can be competitive and they can go off and do tournaments. And then from that point, now the door kind of opens for certificates or a curriculum-based class. So it really does start with the students no matter what, and the professors and the faculty, the passion that they have to support their students in this has been very overwhelming. Actually, as President Parham from Dominguez Hills, his quote, and I think of it all the time, is that he likes to meet students where they are and support them where they are, which means that, you know, they support them through esports, and then it turns into this bigger program where students can get more out of it. So there is an interesting connection there between the students and the professors and faculty, because if they didn't show them that they wanted interest in it, these programs would not exist.
Marisa Martinez is a fellow with CalMatters College Journalism Network. Marisa, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, Memorial Day weekend is right around the corner, where you can get great barbecue here in LA. Evan Kleiman is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15-minute bake-off, Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bam right there.
Pie.
Yes, time to talk about food. Memorial Day is Monday, and we're going to talk about meat again. Last week, we talked about local whole animal butcher shops where you could buy really good meat to cook. But maybe you'd rather kick back and let someone else do the grilling. Evan Kleiman is here to tell us about some barbecue takeout we can get. Yum. I'm already salivating. Hi, Evan.
Hi, Madeline.
Okay. How do you choose? How do you choose?
Well, that, yeah, this was not easy. And also, once I started asking the people I did pick for photographs, then it just became like excruciating.
I know. That you just tortured yourself. Okay, well, there are some spots that are offering specials. So maybe that winnowed it down. What are some of the specials?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily say specials. I would just say that what I kind of honed in on were some of LA's great barbecue spots. There are so many. We've become truly a barbecue town, and it just keeps getting more and more expansive. So I pulled together a list of what I'm calling the stalwarts, places either that have been around for a really long time, like Woody's and Phillips, and then places that started off as pop-ups and backyard places a few years ago, but have now made their way to brick and mortar and have become stalwart parts of the scene.
Oh, okay. Well, let's go with the old stalwarts versus the new stalwarts first.
Okay. So first, I would say, I mean, to me, it's all about Phillips and Woody's. For a million years, I mean, Woody's was my family choice. They're cousins, Woody's and Phillips. Woody's opened in 1975. Mr. Woody Phillip opened it. And it's basically the trinity of pit barbecue, which is brisket, ribs, and sausage, or lynx, as they are called. And it's just incredible, old school, just wonderful smoked meat. Personally, I find the meat so delicious. I barely use any sauce, but both Woody's and Phillips do have amazing sauce.
And is there a difference between Phillips and Woody's?
It's really hard to parse the difference. Everybody's doing pretty much the same thing. Everybody is taking brisket and ribs and lynx, and they are cooking them in a pit barbecue, which means, as opposed to grilling, they're cooking over indirect heat in a closed environment. So you have wood that's been cooked down to embers that is fed into the pit, or else it's a gas-fired pit. And so the meat cooks really slowly. So it's low and slow for hours until it's very, very tender. Each of the places just has little tweaks of what they do. The sauce isn't slathered on while it's in the pit. It's served on the side. And it's all about the meat. And that's true of all of these places who are doing pit barbecue, including the pop-ups.
Now, is there a certain kind of style when it comes to this barbecue? Because, of course, you've heard of Texas versus Kansas City versus South Carolina. Is the difference in those in the sauce or the cooking or both?
I would say that most of the places we see in LA are some form of Texas barbecue. Now, within Texas barbecue, there are four different kinds that are regional. Central Texas is the simplest, dry rub, usually salt and pepper, but some pit masters might have some proprietary rubs. East Texas, the same, slow cooking over indirect heat. Often that's characterized as falling off the bone meat as opposed to pulling it out of the pit when it might have a little bit of resistance. South Texas barbecue often has a sweet sauce, but there's also the inflection from Mexico, where it's known as barbacoa. And then there's West Texas barbecue, which is traditionally cooked over direct heat of an open flame, which is more like grilling than smoking.
Wow, I didn't even know there were these regional differences within Texas. I just thought it was Texas barbecue. So that's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, with food, you can always go down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Delicious ones, hopefully.
Speaking of meat. Okay, so those are the stalwarts, the old stalwarts. What about the new ones?
So we have Bledsoe's, Boneyard Bistro, Maple Block Meat, and Slab Barbecue. And personally, I would choose by location if you want to, because they're all over the city. They range from Mid-City, Sherman Oaks, Culver City, Crenshaw, Inglewood, and Beverly Grove. So you have quite a bit of choice. And also, who isn't sold out? You're better off pre-ordering everything, which, you know, this year that'll be easier and expected because we've been pre-ordering everything mm-hmm. for over a year.
Even now you can pre-order? I mean, it's the end of the week.
Yeah. Pre-order okay. now. Just okay. go on the web, take a look at the list, look through it and pick something and order. I just think it's great. Pick one. Next time, pick a different one. You're going to be eating barbecue all summer long. So this isn't the last chance you have.
All right. So we have the stalwarts. We have the semi-stalwarts or the newer stalwarts. And we also have pop-up restaurants, right?
Right. They're either pop-ups or they're caterers. So these are all places where you have to work a little harder to find them and to order, but we've gotten used to that from pandemic life. Some of these people are doing it out of their backyard. Some people, it's a caterer, so they'll give you an address. You'll go, you'll pick up your single order. And some are trucks. So it's just all over the place, but all of them are worth a trip.
Okay, so give us some highlights.
A's Barbecue is Alan Cruz doing Chicano Soul. Really, really delicious stuff. And I would say that with these particular options, you'll see more of people using their personal identity through this medium of barbecue. So he, for example, is making Al Pastor pork belly. He's doing cafecito ribs with a tamarind glaze, and they're making cochinita pibil for the holiday. So they're pit cooking the cochinita, which is how it's traditionally done anyway. Then there's Angeles. That's Jazzy Harvey, a young woman who's also a model. Her specialty is Jamaican fusion, and she has a jerk chicken specialty. And then you have Dustin Bartz of Bartz Barbecue. That's Texas Barbecue with Prime Meats and Wagyu. Heritage Barbecue down in San Juan Capistrano. Filipino Heritage making pit barbecue. And then we have Maynard. We have Lord Maynard Yera, a.k.a. Kuya Lord, in La Cañada, Flint Ridge. He was the opening sous chef at Bestia and has been working toward opening his own place for years. For the holidays, he's making Filipino versions of pork jowl barbecue, smoked pork ribs, chicken barbecue, ribeye barbecue skewers, and octopus barbecue skewers.
Octopus?
Super. Oh, absolutely. I mean, delicious.
Well, no shortage to choose from. And now I feel racked, no pun intended, with indecision.
I know. I, you know, just, you can literally spend hours just looking at these menus.
And hours more
location,
eating,
location, location.
Okay. Well, Evan, happy Memorial Day weekend. Happy grilling or non-grilling, whatever you plan to do.
Same to you, Madeline. Really enjoy your day off.
Thank you. Evan Kleiman, she hosts KCRW's Good Food. Her list of barbecue takeout recommendations is online now at kcrw.com. That reminds me to remind you that we are going to give you a special program on Memorial Day. It'll be some highlights from our previous show, so the staff can enjoy a well-earned day off. All right, you can download or subscribe to our podcast and listen wherever you want to all the highlights on Press Play. It's at kcrw.com/pressplay or wherever else you get your podcasts. Also want to thank you so much if you contributed during our fundraiser. We really do appreciate every single one of you. So thank you. Thank you for being there when we need you. I'm Madeline Brand, and I'll see you tomorrow.